You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll look at how state officials are working to make Wisconsinites healthier in five key areas: alcohol, tobacco, nutrition and physical activity, suicide prevention, and opioids.
First, Saudi Arabia, Bahrain, Egypt, and the United Arab Emirates cut ties with the Gulf country of Qatar, often pronounced Qatar. Analysts are calling this the worst diplomatic crisis to hit the Gulf Arab states in decades. Some are pointing to President Trump's recent visit to Saudi Arabia as a potential cause of the conflict.
Saeed Khan joins us now. He's a senior lecturer in Near East Asian and Global Studies at Wayne State University. Saeed, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you for having me back, Rob.
Well, bring us to Qatar here and tell us what happened. This is very abrupt. I've seen the word surprising a lot to describe what Saudi Arabia, Egypt, and others have done.
It was. It was quite a shock. As you just mentioned, yesterday, those four countries, Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates, Egypt, and Bahrain, all voted to, or if you want to call it a vote, they all declared that they were severing ties with their neighbor, Qatar. It's a fairly comprehensive break. It includes a blockade, essentially, of by sea, land, and air, which is going to affect airspace, especially for Qatar Airways, a major international airline. Egypt and Saudi Arabia have cut airspace for flights going in and out of Qatar, as well as for Qatar Airways completely. We find that there is also the recalling of ambassadors and the shutting down of embassies. All Qatari visitors to these four countries have 2 weeks to leave and go back to Qatar, as well as a recall of all Saudi, Egyptian, UAE, and Bahraini citizens from those countries. So it's fairly comprehensive.
And in that list, the cutting off of food supplies, Qatar only borders, has a land border with Saudi Arabia. This could have a huge impact on food supplies. Is that right?
Well, 90% of food is imported into Qatar. That's absolutely right. 40% through this land border. So this is going to be very severe. And again, with the restrictions on airspace, that's not just for commercial passenger flights. It's also going to be for cargo, which would be, again, another way for food to get into the country. So we already see that there are runs at supermarkets all across Qatar with people going into a panic. And this is the month of Ramadan, so people are fasting and also making sure that they have food to break their fast.
Now, the United States has a lot at stake here. This is in the Middle East. This ties into a lot of different stories, including terrorism. One of the arguments, as I understand it, from Saudi Arabia, Egypt, and the others, is that Qatar is helping terrorist organizations by providing financial support, they say, providing a physical haven for members of various organizations. Definitely the Muslim Brotherhood, Al-Qaeda funding, fundraising, Al-Qaeda in Syria fundraising in Qatar, and claims that there's support for ISIS as well. What do we know about Qatar and its connections to terrorist organizations?
Well, Qatar is a land of ironies. I mean, first of all, it is the home to U.S. CENTCOM, so there's clearly an American strategic interest with Qatar. But at the same time, Qatar has also kept itself open to being, for lack of better words, a sanctuary for Islamists and people of various stripes of activity in the region, whether it is members of the Muslim Brotherhood, Hamas, or other Islamists. Now, at the same time, when it comes to these aspersions being thrown at Qatar about giving material support to various terrorist groups or extremist groups, we need to be careful because, number one, that is an accusation that can just as easily be made regarding Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates. And second of all, it comes down to the definition of who is considered to be a terrorist by which country or by which one of these monarchies.
Talking to Saeed Khan from Wayne State University about this breakdown in diplomatic ties between Saudi Arabia and Egypt and other countries on the one hand, Qatar, the Gulf state nation, on the other, and what, if anything, it all means for the United States as well. And Saeed, this is a complicated story, another angle here. Saudi Arabia and the others are saying Qatar is too sympathetic to Iran. Now, this is weird. These are Sunni countries saying another Sunni country is too closely aligned with Shia Iran. What do we know about this twist on this story?
Well, this gets down to the crux of the issue, Rob. What we're looking at here is the Gulf Cooperation Council, which is this sort of power broker organization, with Saudi Arabia really being the mothership, but involving Kuwait, Bahrain, United Arab Emirates, Qatar, and as well as Oman. This is, of course, where a lot of energy comes from, natural gas and as well as petroleum. But it is also a Sunni Arab core. And it was thought that this would be the major bulwark against Iran within the region. Now, Qatar has a different attitude toward this. Qatar would rather actually play a more medial or moderating role. A few weeks ago, when the president was in the region, in fact, this coincided with the Iranian elections, and Qatar, in fact, congratulated President Hassan Rouhani of his re-election in Iran, as well as a report out of Qatar that said that Iran is a, quote, big power in the stabilization of the region. These are things that fell in disfavor in Saudi Arabia and the UAE, who were hoping to really maintain this united front of Sunni Arab monarchies against Iran, and they felt emboldened with the president's recent visit, and particularly with his language in the Riyadh speech, doubling down and taking a very strong polarized position. Until now, the United States had certainly gone ahead and favored the Sunni Arab countries, but the language now shows that the U.S. has doubled down on this, particularly within the context of the whole Sunni-Shia sectarian language.
You mentioned the moderating role that Qatar was hoping to play. Now we have United States Secretary of State Rex Tillerson. He was talking about this rift and the role the United States could play. He said this in Australia. Here's a listen.
We certainly would encourage the parties to sit down together and address these differences. And we, if there's any role that we can play in terms of helping them address those, we think it is important that the GCC remain unified.
GCC, the Gulf Cooperation Council that you mentioned, Saeed. So what, if any, role would the United States have in this abrupt tiff here going on?
Well, I mean, if we really want to be cynical about this, we could say that this is an opportunity that, on the one hand, the UAE and the Saudis have escalated this tension with Qatar, and it is allowing for a certain space for the United States to come in, show its diplomatic bona fides, show the leadership of the Trump administration to kind of broker a peace, because the United States, after all, has a lot of vested interest in this region, and it would then be seen as an overture. But it's not going to be without some significant demands being on the negotiation table that the UAE and the Saudis are going to ask for. Number one, they are looking for Qatar to curb what they feel is a lot of critical media coverage. Al Jazeera is based in Qatar. And particularly when it comes to some of the Saudi and the Emirates' diplomatic and foreign policy engagements in the region, case in point, the war in Yemen, Al Jazeera has been rather critical of those two countries. They are, as you said before, also going to demand the expulsion of Muslim Brotherhood leaders, Hamas affiliates, and other Islamists. But they are also going to try to reclaim from Qatar control over the Arab public opinion. That seems to be the most prickly issue and the most contentious reason why they're going after Qatar here.
And then people have been wondering about President Trump's visit to Saudi Arabia as part of his international trip. He met with the leaders of Saudi Arabia and Egypt, among others. People wondering, did he implicitly or explicitly give a green light saying, hey, yeah, you can crack the whip a little bit, try to get Qatar in line? What are people watching for there?
Well, I think they're definitely looking to see whether the Trump factor played a role in this seemingly out of nowhere escalation in the tensions. There had been tensions in 2002, 2014, where the Saudis had similarly recalled their ambassadors because of a tussle that they had with Qatar. But this is taking it to a whole different level. And I think it's interesting to see that the two heirs apparent in Saudi Arabia and in the United Arab Emirates, Mohammed bin Salman in Saudi Arabia, Mohammed bin Zayed in UAE, MBS and MBZ respectively, have been playing ever-increasing roles with the White House of trying to broker regional geopolitics. Several meetings with Jared Kushner, as well as with Rex Tillerson and other officials within the White House. So it seems as though this is part of a broader reshifting of priorities, as well as engagements for both the Trump administration and certainly for Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates.
As we wrap up, Saeed, and this comes as Saudi Arabia is leading an effort in Yemen, a bombing campaign there against rebels, Iranian-backed rebels, supposedly. We've got everything going on in Syria. Is there a thought that this ratcheting up of tensions here could lead to some sort of military conflict between the Saudi Arabia and Qatar, Qatar currently involved in that campaign alongside Saudi Arabia in Yemen?
It seems as though that perhaps is not a likely scenario, in great part because of the fact that the U.S. CENTCOM is there. So the U.S. is going to be very, very allergic to any kind of military engagement between them. And again, after Secretary Tillerson's statement in Australia, the idea of having cooler heads prevail and reach the negotiation table. This, again, is a rather unfortunate escalation, and it is a tense time, but it's probably going to be walked back within the next few months. And to be really flippant about this, we also have to remember that in 2022, Qatar is going to be hosting the FIFA World Cup. The one thing that does galvanize this region of the world is soccer. People will want to go to Qatar. Therefore, there have to be diplomatic relations there.
Saeed, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you, Rob.
That's Saeed Khan, senior lecturer in Near East Asian and Global Studies at Wayne State University. He joined us to talk about how several Arab countries, led by Saudi Arabia and Egypt, have cut diplomatic ties with the Gulf state nation of Qatar, home of a major U.S. military base.
We talked last week about the just-released Healthy Wisconsin Initiative, a plan aimed at improving the health of Wisconsinites in several key areas: alcohol, nutrition and physical activity, opioid suicide, and tobacco.
But how will these recommendations be put into practice? A key official from the Wisconsin Department of Health Services joins us now for a look at how the state will try to boost public health.
Karen McEwen joins us now. She's the state health officer for Wisconsin. Karen, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, first, briefly, how did the Department of Health Services come up with these areas of improvement?
We didn't come up with these on our own. We pulled together a steering committee that was made up mostly of people that do not work for the state, but who live in communities and work in places around Wisconsin. So we had rural representatives, people from cities, people from various backgrounds, but who are experts and know a lot about health and what's happening in public health. And they applied some criteria to a lot of different issues to help identify what would make a big difference if we could move the needle between now and about 2020.
So you've got your goal set. You know the areas that you need to improve upon. So now what is the first step? How do you go about turning that into actionable items that people can get on board with and that there can be partnerships involving and all to get to this mutual goal of making Wisconsin healthier?
So the first step was identifying these focus areas, and then the next step is going to be to pull together teams of people, again, experts who know a lot now about these subjects, to help put together recommendations and specific plans that communities can implement to make a difference for health. And then a second piece is that we'll be asking communities to share what they are doing in these areas and share success stories so that other communities across Wisconsin can learn from each other and implement best practices.
And I gather the goals set by this Healthy Wisconsin report have 2020 as the time when some of the improvements should be visible. Why 2020?
So the Healthy Wisconsin was built on the framework of an existing 10-year state health plan, and that's called Healthiest Wisconsin 2020. And so this was an opportunity to spend the last years of that plan trying to really focus on some important issues and try to move the needle. And then in 2020, we'll be developing another 5-year plan for moving forward.
And one of the report's objectives is to increase the consumption of healthy foods and beverages, probably not so much soda on that list. Can you talk about some of the main strategies centered around having people make healthier choices, eat healthier stuff?
Absolutely. So eating healthy and being physically active is really important to maintaining health throughout our lives, so that as we get older, we can continue to be healthy and active. So some of the activities will involve making sure that healthy beverages and healthy foods are available in a variety of venues. So we work with schools, we work with workplaces, we work with communities to make sure that people have access to healthy foods and beverages.
And so what if those options are there? Let's say you're a student at a school and now you have a salad bar maybe, and you didn't have a salad bar before. What can you do to change the behavior so that the student chooses, you know, the salad bar instead of a hamburger and fries?
Absolutely. Well, so that's a great example is schools, because some of the schools around the state are practicing having school gardens as well. And what they're learning is that sometimes when students grow the vegetables, they're a lot more interested in tasting them, trying them out, and finding out that, oh, it turns out I really do like vegetables. So there are strategies in place to help create that demand as well.
And what about addressing areas that might not have access because they might be something, a place deemed a food desert, where there's just not a place to buy healthy food? What are some strategies there?
So that's another thing that communities around the state are looking at. And those strategies can range from bringing in small points of sale, working with existing vendors to say, you know, to see if there are ways that they could bring in some healthier options. And then certainly some communities are looking at how could they have a grocery store in their area.
We're talking with Karen McEwen right now, State Health Officer for Wisconsin, and she's with us to talk about the new Healthy Wisconsin initiative that looks to move the needle on a variety of goals by the year 2020. Areas like alcohol consumption, nutrition, exercise, opioids, mental health, and tobacco. And Karen, in terms of What could be brought in to give people better options, sticking with nutrition, for instance, but I guess this could be applied to any number. Will there be any sort of a metric to incentivize these choices for people or for the stores and businesses that can provide the food?
So part of what we'll be doing is pulling together a group of people that are experts in this field and having them put together policy recommendations that communities can pick from, so that every community can look and see in our area what's most likely to work well. Some of the toolkits that already exist provide sort of a starting point to have conversations with grocery stores and other food sellers, with restaurants, with schools, with child care centers, so that all of those different settings can look at what would work really well for them to help provide healthy options in communities.
Okay, and let's talk about another area now, increasing physical activity. And this is one that you can have an amped up, let's say, physical education program in a school if you're someone who's outside that school zone and you have to make these choices on your own. How do you get people to choose to exercise more?
So starting in school and even earlier than school age is definitely a good place to focus. And so in addition to physical education programs, some schools are looking at how can they have kids more active throughout the day. Beyond school, as you say, one thing that communities look at is allowing the community to use school facilities after school hours. And so that's an approach that some communities are using. I also know that a lot of communities in Wisconsin are really trying to promote what Wisconsin already offers, which is a lot of opportunities to get out and be physically active. And some communities are doing that by building or expanding walking and biking trails so that people have a safe place to engage in those activities without having to worry about traffic.
And I suppose for a lot of this, it's education, getting the word out that these resources will be there.
Absolutely.
Mental health. We haven't touched on mental health yet. What are some of the goals and thoughts about how they might be achieved?
So several of these issues do touch on mental health, and that includes suicide, opioid misuse, and alcohol. And so we're working closely with our mental health partners to look at those, and actually all five of them, because people who struggle with mental health diagnoses also may struggle to eat healthy food, be physically active, and then smoking is also an issue. So working closely with mental health partners, I think public health and mental health haven't always seen each other as as vital partners, and that conversation is really happening at the state level and in communities, and then trying to see what do each of us bring to the table so that we can really enhance our work.
Right. That's an interesting point, Karen, that a lot of these, we may think of them as discrete areas of discipline on their own, eating healthfully, getting exercise, staying away from tobacco. But how much overlap is there? If everyone comes together and comes up with a coordinated strategy, is that something that you're looking at to be more comprehensive going forward?
Absolutely. We're hoping that if we can get people across the state to work on as many of these five priorities, and by having it five that it's a manageable list, that we can really make a difference and that we can maybe get some non-traditional partners looking at these issues as well. And then the steering committee also recognized that one of several themes that runs through these is adverse childhood experiences, that children who have had adverse experiences as they were growing up are also more likely to struggle with these and other health issues.
Right. We talked about that quite a bit on the show last week. Any thoughts about how to address those adverse childhood experiences and then help the child in the moment so that the future is brighter?
Absolutely. So obviously the first thing we'd like to do would be to prevent children from experiencing these adverse experiences. But if they do, early intervention is certainly key, and trying to make sure that those experiences don't pile on. These adverse childhood experiences sort of have a dose effect. So if you have one, that's difficult. But if you start having four or more, then we really see worse outcomes. So trying to find the children who've had one or two experiences and then provide them additional resources. And then even kids who've had many adverse childhood experiences, we know, for example, that the presence of a caring adult in their life can make a huge difference.
We'll leave it there. Karen, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you so much.
That was Karen McEwen, State Health Officer for Wisconsin, with us there to talk about the new Healthy Wisconsin Initiative. If you're a parent or a teacher, you may be familiar with a daily occurrence: sleepy kids who are just not ready to face class. And the students who say it's too early to get up may actually be onto something.
A new study shows that students who start school even an hour later perform better academically, especially older students.
Sam Norris joins us now. He's a graduate student and researcher at Northwestern University. He's the co-author of a study that looks at student achievement and later class times. Sam, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, happy to be here.
Sam, what exactly were you looking for in this study?
Well, you know, we've known for a long time that there might be some sort of relationship between start times and academic performance. And I think that this is something that everyone that's been a student or been a parent can attest to. And so what we wanted to do in this paper is we wanted to look at how important that is at different ages of kids. And the reason why we think that's so important and so interesting is that if we can sketch out how important start times are for academic achievement over the age range of children, we can start to move towards policies like moving start times earlier for older kids and later for older kids and earlier for younger kids, but still keep school starting at the same time on average, which is very important for parents.
And this could be a big deal. We know how difficult it is to make meaningful achievement, meaningful advancements in education and student achievement. So if it could be something is relatively simple, we understand there are logistics involved, but if it could be start times move the needle, that would be something that would be pretty significant, wouldn't it?
Absolutely. So what we find in our paper is that for adolescent kids, moving start times an hour later increases achievement in math by about what we call 0.07 standard deviations. Now, that is basically costing nothing. And for a point of reference, when you make school class sizes maybe down from about 25 to about 18, that's improving test scores by about 0.2 standard deviations. But, you know, that costs millions and millions of dollars a year. So this is something that is about a third as good as reducing class sizes, but it's just orders and orders of magnitude cheaper.
Now, you looked at a couple of different time zones in Florida, Central and Eastern, and students who moved from one to the other. Can you tell us how you set your study up?
Right. So, in general, in in research, what we want to do is compare people that are similar in all in basically every dimension except what we're interested in, which is school start times in this case. So it might be true that schools that start later are just better schools in a whole bunch of ways that we can observe and that we can't observe. So we didn't want to just compare schools that start later and schools that start earlier and see how children do. What we did instead is we look at the time zone boundary, and we noticed that when kids move over that time zone boundary, there's a very sharp change in how much light before school they receive. And that's just because the sunrise time moves by an hour over the time zone boundary, and the actual school start time is measured by the clock, doesn't. So you get a very sharp change, and you can see how test scores change when kids move right over that boundary. And because school or because light is embedded so deeply into how humans set their circadian rhythm, it's analogous to schools changing the actual clock start time.
So it's really the body's internal rhythm, the circadian rhythm, and not so much the clock itself.
Right. And you know, one of the things that really struck us when we were doing this paper is how deeply embedded these patterns are in the biology. And so we look at how big these effects are for kids of different ages. For girls, we see school start times start to matter at about age 11. And for boys, they start to matter at about age 13. And those are the exact ages when kids are progressing through the precise stage of puberty that's related to the circadian rhythm.
So there's something specific in puberty that makes it a bigger deal when school starts, huh?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that this suggests that it's hard to tell kids just to buck up and get with the program, that the changing physiology is just something that you can only work around so much.
We're talking with Sam Norris right now from Northwestern University. He's a co-author of a study that looked at start times in schools and found that a later start time usually means better academic outcomes for students, in particular for older students. And Sam, we know the American Academy of Pediatrics recommends starting high school, for instance, no earlier than 8:30 in the morning. A lot of schools don't do this. Why have school districts been slow to adopt this?
Well, I think that the main barrier is that parents need to get to work on time, and so in order to drop their kids off at school before work, school just gets pushed earlier and earlier. What I think is not quite so sad is the idea that high schools have to start before elementary schools, which is the case in about 50% of the schools that we looked at. And so what we think is that that's a margin that school districts can play with, still allow parents to get to school on time, but actually allow the teenagers in the school district to get a little bit more sleep before school.
And have you heard, our school districts who have started to make changes like this, have they heard back from parents who are pushing back against this idea, or do they support it? Because I can imagine if a school starts earlier for little kids, you know, for instance, in the winter in Wisconsin, it may be dark outside when your student is waiting for the bus. So are there other logistics here?
Yeah, so there's a lot of factors to consider. Little kids waiting outside in the dark for the bus, that's a big one. A lot of school districts are concerned about the effects on sports, because they want their students to be able to practice sports after school. I think that there's a pretty wide range of things that this affects. You know, this is, in general, a policy that is really hard to push through unless you get a lot of parent buy-in. And so what we wanted to do here is just quantify the academic benefits of later start times so that parents are able to weigh that off against all the other possible effects.
We're talking to Sam Norris right now from Northwestern University, where he's a researcher, and he's the co-author of a study that looked at start times in schools and found that a later start time usually means better academic outcomes for students.
And you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Are you a teacher or school administrator who finds that tired students aren't performing well? Have you made the case for later start times in your district? If you're a student or a parent, do you think a later start time is a good idea? Do you think it would improve performance? Or are there other obstacles that you think maybe should slow us down on this later start time idea? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll continue our conversation in just a bit here on Central Time.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We're continuing our conversation about how academic outcomes could be improved by having classes start later in the day. Sam Norris is with us. He's a graduate student and researcher at Northwestern University, and he recently co-authored a study looking at this issue.
You could join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Do you think schools, and mainly we're talking about age 11 or 13 and up, especially high school, do you think these schools should start their school day later? Our guest says his research shows that would help academic performance. Are you on board? If you're a parent, a teen yourself, or you work in the schools, what do you think of the idea? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And let's take a caller now. We have Graham joining us in Arlington. Graham, hi.
Hey, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
So first, I'd just like to clarify, this study came from Florida. Is that correct?
Yep, that's right.
Okay. I was wondering if, based on latitude, then your guest might think that there's some correlation with, again, the circadian rhythm, because obviously northern latitudes have greater variation in day length than southern latitudes.
Mm-hmm. Graham, thank you for that question. And Sam, what about that latitude and different degrees of sunlight? I know in Wisconsin in winter, the light can be pretty thin, you know, even in the morning. What do you think about that variable?
Well, that's a great thought. And so, you know, as Graham said, we're looking at Florida, where compared to Wisconsin, there's actually not that much variation in sunlight. So, you know, we haven't actually done the research to support this, but my guess is that in a place like Wisconsin, where you see even earlier sunrises and even later sunrises, I think that school start times are actually going to be slightly more important because kids are really getting slammed in the winter by the early start times.
Graham, thanks a lot for that question. Appreciate it. And we're going to go next to Kristen in Wanakee. Kristen, hello.
Hi, I think this is a great idea. The school district that my kids attended, or still attend, the elementary school starts before the high school, and the elementary school drop-off starts at 7:30 with classes beginning at 7:45. So mom and dad can drop off on their way to work and still make it into work by about 8 o'clock. And the high school, it starts at 8:15, 8:20, so it's not quite as late as I would like it personally. But the brilliant thing for the late start in the high school is that the high school drivers, who are newer and inexperienced, are on the road after the elementary schoolers are already in their seats in their classrooms. So in addition to it, I think being great from an academic standpoint, it's fantastic from just a safety standpoint of all of the students involved.
Kristen, interesting for that observation. Sam, what about that safety issue?
You know, I think that with school start times in general, safety is a huge issue, and this is like a great example of a way that moving the high school drivers off the road earlier is potentially going to improve safety for the elementary school students.
We're talking right now about later school start times. If you're a parent, if you're a teacher, is this something that you think is going to help your child, your student, to get to school, especially in middle school and high school, a little bit later, to have a little more sunlight helping get the circadian rhythm synced up and maybe better outcomes in school? Call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. And Sam, is there an optimum time that you came up with? We know the American Academy of Pediatrics says no earlier than 8:30, but if you could write the laws, when would high school, for instance, start?
Well, you know, it's hard to say based on what we've done. It looks like at all the start times that we're looking at, which kind of run the range from 7:30 to 8:30, that later is better. So I think that from where we're at, I think that, you know, we don't really know what the optimum is. We know that probably it should be a little bit later, but I think we're actually going to have to get there to learn anything about how much further we should go.
It's interesting. I mean, if I think back to being in high school, on weekends, I probably slept till about noon, but I don't think that means that high school should go from noon until 8 o'clock at night. But I mean, should we be thinking about pushing the envelope a little more?
Well, absolutely. And, you know, another interesting thing related to the start times is that one of the things we found in the paper is that this thing that teens do where they catch up on sleep on the weekend is much more pronounced in areas where the start times for the schools are a little bit earlier.
Hmm.
And so I think this is, you know, more evidence pushing on the start times being too early for the teens, and they get more and more tired over the week, and then they try and make it up during the weekend.
Interesting. So it could be that teenage sleeping that we think of as being such a hallmark of being a teenager is also the product of an early start time.
Absolutely.
Take another call. David is with us from Ironwood, Michigan. David, hello.
Yeah, I think it's a good idea. I'm just curious, has there any research been done on workers starting later, if that would improve their productivity?
Ah, David, good point there. Should workers begin later as well if they have maybe some latitude within their place of employment to come in a little later? Is that to everybody's benefit?
So I think that probably it's the most important for teenagers, that biologically that's the point in our lives when we're the most sensitive to sunlight and when our sleep schedules are shifted the latest. But there's a lot of good research that's also about the productivity angle. There's a paper by Matt Gibson and Jeff Schrader that shows that it's actually using the same device, looking at time zones, that areas that are in or areas where the sunrise is early relative to when work starts, the wages are actually higher, productivity seems to be higher. And so I think that this is evidence that, yeah, even for adults, more sleep is going to lead to better productivity.
And let's take one more quick call from Anne Marie in Waukesha. Anne Marie, hi.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I just wanted to say real quick, I've attended 10 schools since kindergarten, most of which were in Florida, and I've worked with middle and high school students, and I just fear that if school starts later and thus ends later, it'll ruin the schedule of students getting off of school, having time to get their homework done before supper, and then having family time or anything like that afterwards.
Right. Great thought, Anne-Marie. Appreciate that. And Sam, we could possibly be talking about the disruption of time-honored patterns. You get home from school, you have time to chill out, you start your homework, maybe you see your family or you get some exercise. If school starts later, all of a sudden, the end of the day gets a little more squished, doesn't it?
Absolutely. And, you know, this is all about trade-offs. And there are certainly costs to pushing school later. You know, there's sports. There's just the way that people are planning on organizing their day. And I think that it's not immediately obvious that we should sacrifice all that for academic achievement. But I think that what we've shown is that the academic gains are actually relatively high. And so that's something that I think at least we should be thinking about.
And Sam, that's a great place to leave it. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
We're talking there with Sam Norris, graduate student at Northwestern University in the School of Economics. He was with us to discuss a study that he co-authored, which found that starting school later in the day led to better academic outcomes, especially for teenagers. And you can let us know what you think about this idea. Would you be up for doing that, moving that start time later, especially for older kids? Let us know on the Central Time Facebook page.
Last week, WPR told you how some hospitals are serving meat raised without antibiotics to try and curb the rise of highly resistant bacteria known as superbugs. Today, Shemaine Mills looks at other reasons hospital food is starting to change.
Hospital food, once the butt of jokes, is aiming to be as fresh and appetizing as a meal cooked at home or in a decent restaurant. But the food isn't just meant to please patients' palates. Rather, some hospitals are looking at the big picture, trying not only to serve food that's good to eat, but is purchased locally and raised in a way that doesn't damage the environment. In a word, sustainability. At a forum this winter on the state's role in food systems and nutrition, UW Health's head chef, Ellen Ritter, explained how they want to buy more produce, meat, and dairy from Wisconsin that's sustainably raised.
When you look at the amount of money we spend and the volume of food that we purchase every year, there's a big need to do it in a very smart way.
Ritter cites studies compiled by the American Independent Business Alliance, which shows on average 48% of every purchase at a local independent business recirculates locally as compared to 14% through a chain store or big distributor.
So that's huge if we can keep almost half of every dollar spent recirculating here, either in our county or in our state.
With 2.7 million meals served at University Hospital and nearby Children's Hospital each year, it's a big operation. They use large food distributors to get everything from fish to produce. But operating on a big scale doesn't mean they can't think small, says Ritter.
We really try to work with those big distributors to bring on local products and use our buying power in a positive way. So now we're able to source all of our frozen vegetables locally, most organically.
Recently, Ritter oversaw a delivery of meat coming in from the distributor Nesbigs. The truck driver rolls a dolly over an uneven ramp to get goods onto the hospital loading dock, which is already filled with crates of fruit and vegetables.
So this is our produce. We actually just recently switched over. All of our produce used to come in cardboard boxes, and now it comes in these crates. So they're reusable crates. We just did it to try and cut down on the vast amount of cardboard that we were generating every day.
UW Hospital is buying more produce as it tries to steer patients, visitors, and staff toward vegetable entrees. They offer them at a lower cost than, say, a cheeseburger. Amy Mim is a nutrition specialist at UW Hospital. She said salad sales have soared.
And we can use creative pricing strategies and menu engineering. And with that, we have witnessed over this past year a tremendous increase in consumer acceptance, if you will, as well as consumer purchasing towards healthier options.
There's a similar effort at Gunderson Health System in La Crosse, where they've also implemented a less meat, better meat policy recommended by the organization Practice Green Health. Sarah Ashbeck is a food service program director at Gunderson.
We're increasing the number of vegetarian options we have available, and with the money saved there, we'll be able to put that money towards sustainable foods such as beef and chicken that are a higher price.
Ashbeck says the conventionally raised beef they now buy costs $2.50 a pound. Grass-fed beef, she says, is almost $6 a pound. But some hospitals are choosing to focus less on the bottom line because they believe the benefits to human health, the environment, and local economy are priceless. Shemaine Mills, Wisconsin Public Radio.